What other brand can we talk about in all of cycling where the probably the majority of our listeners have used it?
It's a lightweight wheels.
Besides lightweight wheels.
We can't move on yet. I just remembered my biggest problem with Strava.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You do an Everest thing, like 76 times with more gap, and within 90 days, you've lost your local legend status.
You got to space it out. That's the problem.
Welcome back to Geek Warning, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. It's Thursday, February 16th. It's good to be back. We got a lot to talk about today. We have quite an extensive list of nerdy, geeky things to talk about. And joining me, of course, Dave Rome. Welcome.
Hello. Hello. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening.
Three wildly different time zones podcast at the moment. There's literally like 1 hour of the day that we can make this podcast, and it is right now.
Yep. It's 7 a.m. for me. I don't know. What's it for you, Kaylee?
It's like 1 p.m. I'm the one that gets the easy time here.
Okay.
And Ronan?
It's 20:20 for me. Time, 8:20 p.m.
8:20 p.m. So there we go. This is our one. It's our one window. Listeners don't care about this.
Yeah.
Welcome, Ronan.
How are you? All right. We'll move on.
I'm good. I'm listening to you two guys talking about breakfast and lunch. I'm wishing I could go back to that and have more coffee, but it's much too late in my evening for more coffee.
The good news for you, though, is you are only one sleep away from more coffee. You're actually ahead of us.
You know I don't like sleeping.
I know, because all of our meetings are at like 10 p.m. your time. All right, we got, like I said, a fair amount to talk about today. We're going to give you a little update on what's going on at Parley and their restructuring. There is a lawsuit playing out in Florida, I believe, right, Ronan? Between SRAM and Princeton Carbon this week around wheels. And I think we talked about this previously. You've probably seen the news around this previously, but we're going to dig into what's going on there, what some of the arguments are from either side. We're going to talk a little bit about the S-Works of Cannondale in a little bit, and some news out of Strava. Their CEO is stepping down again, and we're going to talk about what that means. Dave Rome, you've got some suggestions around brake bleeding. We'll get into it at the very end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But let's kick off with Parley. So do we have any significant updates? We talked about this on a recent show. We said that they were having some issues. They were going through restructuring. Where are we now?
I guess that's me. Basically, it's not any real major news from what we discussed last week. I guess the good news is that it appears from, at least from a public-facing point of view, they have restructured. And all is well. They're back on track. They're claiming that they're going to continue on from their 23 years of custom carbon bike building. And yeah, it does seem like, at least from the outside, that the custom side of things is carrying on as almost business as usual. Yeah, we're still, I guess, early days. We'll find out with time whether that includes the production frames out of Asia. But yeah, good news for a brand of notoriety.
Yeah, excellent news. And I guess sort of proof that these restructuring episodes do not have to be a death sentence, right?
Yeah.
In fact, that's the whole point of Chapter 11, right?
Correct.
That it is not automatically a death sentence. It's not always the easiest thing to navigate,
mm-hmm.
but it is not a death sentence. So good news for other brands that are perhaps pointed in the same direction.
Yeah. Yeah, I think those restructuring endeavors are going to become a common sight over the next few months, year, 2 years, as everyone finds themselves with a lot of stock bloat following the pandemic. And yeah, I think it's Parley's quick move to being back on track is a good sign.
Very good sign. It's a brand we love. Ronan, interesting news tidbit out of Florida. Actually, of all places this week, there is a trial about to begin between SRAM and Princeton Carbon Works. I'm actually, why don't I just read you the first paragraph of this law story about it. Bicycle components manufacturer SRAM Corp on Monday accused Princeton Carbon Works of infringing its two bicycle wheel designs, alleging during opening statements before a Miami federal jury that its rival copied the company despite already knowing patents already existed. So this is SRAM accusing Princeton Carbon Works of using a design that, in fact, it was licensing from a name that will be familiar to a lot of our listeners, Dimitris Katsanis, and that accusation is now going to trial in Miami this week. Ronan, what else can you tell me about this?
Not much. You've kind of summed up quite a lot.
Let's do your thunder. I apologize.
No, well, we should probably say this is probably not news to anybody. The news or the update this week is that it's actually come to trial. Now, I think everybody sort of knew SRAM and Zips sort of complaints with Princeton's design. And it's actually almost a full 2 years ago that they initially kicked off these proceedings and basically asked Princeton to stop copying their wavy wheel design, which Zip have, as you said, unlicensed from Dimitris Katsanis, the brains behind quite a lot of the Team GB track bikes over the past couple of decades, and of course Filippo Ganna's 3D printed Pinarello track frame in October of last year. Well, Katsanis had this patent for wavy wheels, which I think he copied from humpback whales, which, yeah, maybe humpback whales have a bigger case here than anybody, but leaving the whales aside for a second, Zip have that wavy rim design on license from Katsanis, and when Princeton popped up with their wavy wheel rim design in 2017, yeah, Zip didn't like it all that much. So fast forward to today, and we're getting a bit more details on exactly what it is SRAM's case is, and what Princeton's defense is. And basically, long story short, SRAM are claiming that Dimitris and themselves licensing it from him have a patent on this wavy wheel rim design, which is said to improve the aerodynamics of the rim, decrease drag, and they are claiming that Princeton have effectively copied that design. And yeah, they're not too happy about that. Basically, they are seeking damages of about $9.5 million stemming from lost profits, or at least $2.9 million in terms of lost royalties. So, you know, it's fairly big numbers we're talking about here. Relatively big numbers that we're talking about here.
Yeah, for bicycle wheels, for sure. Certainly, I mean, that's like six lightweight wheels.
With inflation, it's probably about five lightweight wheels.
Oh, okay, right. So,
but yes, it's a heck of a lot of money. And yes, basically, they're saying that Princeton Carbon Works design also copied the undulating configuration with the convex peaks on the inside of the rim. So, the wheels definitely have a similarity amongst them. You know, you can see that just by looking at them. But you know, we should say that Princeton Carbon Works are denying infringing the patent there, and basically their defense is that Dimitris Katsanis or Zip or SRAM or whoever can't patent something that was already invented, and they are pointing to a patent that was listed in, I believe, like 1999 for a similar rim design. And what Princeton are now basically their defense is that since this patent was already in existence and has actually expired at this point, Katsanis was only allowed to patent something very limited and specific, and since his inventions were only modifications of the original design, that sort of frees them up to make modifications of the original design also. So,
wow,
yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it goes.
It's amazing how drawn out it is as well. Like, what, we're 5 years after that claim was first put forward by SRAM, and and I'm sure this isn't going to be a quick case either. A quick trial.
Yeah, well, I think SRAM or Zip first launched this rim design in November of 2016. And one of the things they actually pointed out this week was that Princeton Carbon Works filed their own application on the very same day that Zip launched that RIM. So that's an interesting coincidence, I guess. Mm. But, you know, Princeton, their point is, well, you know, we were already working on this design before we knew anything about your wheels, and our wheels came out within a matter of months after that. So,
well, none of us are lawyers.
No.
So no. I don't think we're going to try to pinpoint which direction this will go. You could definitely see why SRAM and Zip are kind of annoyed, because they are, I would imagine, paying for that licensing. And mm-hmm. if they didn't believe that the idea was patentable and therefore licensable, then they would have just made this anyway, right? They would have just made wavy wheels without paying Dimitris Katsenis for it. So they clearly believe that the patent is valid, or else they wouldn't be paying to license that design. And then another company has gone off and decided to do the opposite. So an interesting bit of an interesting industry kerfuffle.
Indeed.
Princeton argued that Katsenis simply patented a design with alternating bulges on the inside of the rims, whereas the shapes of their clients' designs were more akin to peaks instead of bulges that are curved like a dome. So if anybody out there knows their peaks and bulges and the differences between them, perhaps we could sort this whole thing out outside of court.
Lawyers. Well, like I said, we don't know how this is going to go. We're just going to keep an eye on it, and I can't imagine it's going to wrap up particularly quickly, like you said, Dave. So we'll just, we'll keep an eye on it.
The trial is expected to last 2 weeks.
I mean, so we got two episodes then, three episodes. I mean, if SRAM wins this, it's a lot of money for Princeton. Like, that would do some serious damage to them. So that's why, I guess that's why this really matters, right? It's like, this is maybe not hanging in the balance, maybe not a company hanging in the balance, but probably pretty close.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on from courtroom and things that are, frankly, no pun intended, slightly out of our wheelhouse, and get into what I kind of teased earlier. And actually, Cannondale has teased this a fair amount as well. And I believe the embargo was up yesterday, so now we can officially talk about it. Dave Rome, tell me what Lab 71 is.
I can tell you what it isn't, which is at this point a new bike.
Is it where they study aliens?
It's where they,
study aliens.
Maybe. We don't know. Cannondale's being a little bit vague on this. To be honest, I do know more about this than I can probably lead on at this time. But basically, Lab 71 is, the simplest way to put it, is it's Cannondale's equivalent to S-Works. It's their new top-end performance-driven racing line of product. We haven't seen said product yet. But yeah, you can imagine that there's going to be bikes coming that sit at the very, very top end. And given that it's S-Works-y, you can imagine that it's probably carbon fiber bikes with higher grade carbon fiber being used than others in the lineup. Flagship components, really stuff that is probably given to the best riders that they sponsor and is the best that they can do as a company.
I'm sure they're going to love you describing it as like S-Works.
Yeah, I'm sure that is not going to go down great. But I mean, that's like as a simple way, like, you know, Specialized has done that very successfully in the marketplace, and everyone's familiar with what that is. And that's for me the easiest way to explain that without repeating their press release.
But there is actually a much easier way, is that, you know, if Cannondale actually acknowledged the bike that is already in existence, that is already winning races.
What bike?
Then we could talk about
Brandon,
it.
What bike? And,
well, I mean, I watch bike racing on TV. So
yeah.
I've seen Nielsen Paulus and a couple of other... My hard drive doesn't like me talking about this. It just leaped off the table in an attempt to keep me quiet.
It's a bit.
Basically, what I'm saying is that there is, you know, EF are racing this year with a new Cannondale that says Lab 71 on the seat post, and presumably that is going to be the first in the new Lab 71 range.
Don't know what you're talking about.
No idea, Ryan.
You don't watch road racing, do you?
I'm pretty sure that's just the old bike.
Rome, we were talking about this before we hit record, and you pointed out that it's made the press release quite funny, because the poor marketing department over at Cannondale had to figure out how to write about Lab 71 without specifically talking about any of the bikes that are coming soon, right?
Yeah.
We've all had to write around things, right? Try to write around facts, and it's just a big pile of that, which makes it kind of a humorous read for us at this point.
But so Lab 71 moving forward will be Cannondale's very top tier flagship product, and it's racing driven is the thing that they want to get forward for people. So it's not, say like the old, what was it, Black Ink edition bikes that they used to do as a company. Was it Black Ink? I feel like it was Black Ink.
Yeah.
So those were like their flagship, like really cool brand bikes with like cost no limit parts. So you'd see like Chris King hubs and MB rims and all sorts of stuff that their teams wouldn't be allowed to ride due to sponsors, but it'd just be stuff that their product managers just thought were like, what would I do on my own bike? This Lab 71 is different. It's literally like creating the highest performance product they can. It's not going to be limited to road. They'll be in mountain bike and basically any other racing discipline that Cannondale dabbles in. You can probably imagine it at some point they'll launch a Lab 71 edition of.
Are we going to get a Lab 71 CAD? Because that's really what I want.
I would love that. I vaguely recall asking them about that and was told no, but but yeah, maybe they can prove me wrong. We'll see.
That would be amazing. I mean, you know, if you're going to build the world's best crit bike, that's what it would be, right?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Lab 71 CAD, what are we on, 14, 15, 16?
Yeah. I don't know how you'd use a higher level of carbon fiber layup with that model, but yes.
You could do even fancier aluminium, sorry.
That's true.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's true. You could put carbon tubes in between it.
Ooh.
613 reboot.
That would be awesome. I love that bike back in the day.
I would buy one.
Well, I like seeing it. I mean, just from a, you know, this is a tech podcast, not a marketing podcast, but I think it's clever. It clearly works for Specialized. It works elsewhere. It works in the car industry, for example. It's a good way to tell people. It's a good way for the consumer to immediately identify what this bike's purpose is. Mm. And ironically, even if that purpose doesn't fit their use, it can still be quite a useful marketing tool, right? I mean, think about all the people on S-Works bikes that are never going to race them.
Yeah.
But it just says, it says fast, it says quality. So I think it's a smart thing to do. And frankly, like the bikes will probably be pretty sweet, right? Because whenever they put that much time and attention into making a bike as quick as possible, it's probably something that we're going to be pretty into.
Exactly. And there are some like new emerging resins and carbon fiber, like high modulus carbon fibers that are very difficult to work with or very expensive to work with, because say they might have like a very short shelf life when you start to use them. So you have to use up that pre-preg carbon very quickly. You can't just keep it around in storage for very long. And that has inherent cost, and that cost is something that you can't just put into your regular lineup, because you're going to offend people with the pricing that you have to have. So it is kind of cool to have this like flagship product that's kind of almost unapologetic with what it costs. It's just like, you know, a sign of what we can do versus what we should do for market relevance.
I feel like we're kind of contradicting ourselves here, because we often lament such things, but I think that what we actually lament is 105 bikes costing $8,000. I don't think any of us have anything against, I have nothing against $20,000 bikes. I think I probably won't buy one, but I have nothing against them because they exist in this sort of like other stratosphere that it's just interesting for its own, on its own merits.
Yeah,
it's not
our previous
intended to be available to everybody.
Yeah, our previous issue with the $20,000 bikes is that they really existed in many cases to sell more $13,000 or $15,000 bikes. And I'm not convinced that that's the case here with Lab 71. I think from what I've seen, I think Cannondale will continue to offer a sensible product beneath it.
Give me a Lab 71 CAD. That's all I want. All right. It is time.
In the meantime, Dave, if you watch the Volta Algarve tomorrow, you might see a Lab 71. The guy in the yellow jersey has a bike that says Lab 71.
Still don't know what you're talking about. I'm so sorry.
I don't know if it's the same bike or not, but have a look and see what you think.
Is that an NDA I smell, Dave? Is there a...
I actually didn't sign one. I'm just playing by the rules.
You're just
playing
nice.
By the verbal agreement we had. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on from Lab 71. Another thing we're going to keep an eye on, and I guarantee you we will be talking about again soon. So let's move on to some Strava news. I feel like we're being a little bit less techie this week, a little more like industry.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just a slow week or what, but we're just,
we'll fix that later.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on in the industry right now, to be perfectly honest, and we're interested in it. We hope you are as well. One of the big ones in the last week was that the CEO of Strava, Michael Corbath, announced that he's not imminently resigning, but he announced that the search for his successor has begun.
Again.
And he's the current CEO. He's also one of the co-founders. He helped get Strava off the ground, and then he actually left for a while. And then he came back, remind me, Dave, was it 3 years ago, something like that?
Feels about right, yeah.
4 years ago. Yeah. The pandemic messes with my time scales.
I feel like 2019's right, yeah.
Yeah, so he came back to Strava and kind of led the shift toward more of a kind of subscription model and trying to get revenue straight out of its users. They've been chasing all kinds of things previously. They've been chasing advertising. They've been chasing all kinds of weird stuff.
He righted the ship.
I would say he pretty successfully righted the ship. There's been some stumbles, not least of which were in the last couple of weeks around pricing and things like that. But in general, I think he pointed Strava in the right direction. And I don't think we need to beat around the bush here to say that, you know, we in general are fans of companies going to their actual user base for their revenue. It tends to make for a better product, I think. I think that's kind of borne out with Strava. I know that there are still some frustrations out there with a lot of the things that Strava does, but if you cast your mind back to 4 or 5 years ago, they were much more adrift than they are right now. And with that pivot to turning their users into, their customers, they've kind of improved on that. And I think a lot of that was from Horvath. So,
yeah.
What does this mean for Strava going forward, though? What are we taking from this?
I think... it's a tough one for them. I think they play in a fairly difficult space where they're kind of currently appealing to mass market cyclists, but a lot of those mass market cyclists get what they want out of the app without having to pay. Mm-hmm. Whereas the really dedicated training focused cyclist such as Ronan is probably using a more sophisticated training platform like a Training Peaks or Today's Plan or something like that. That's also a paid service, and you're probably not going to pay for both services because they overlap quite a bit. So for me, I don't know, like I don't have the answer, but I see the struggle that is ahead with this company, and it's so interesting to see a company of this size in this predicament.
Yeah, I think I mentioned this in our little WhatsApp chat that it Strava for a long time to me has felt like a utility, right? It feels like an electric utility or like the way you get your gas or something like that. That just sort of, it almost just exists in the background. You know, everybody uses it, and it would be kind of devastating if it actually went away. But you don't really ever think about it. Like, you know, when my rides finish, I stop my Wahoo watch and it just goes to Strava. Right. And it just keeps track of what I've done. And I'm not training for anything in particular, really. And I don't really care about my TSS and whatever else like Training Peaks can get me. I just want to kind of keep track of what I'm doing and, you know, be able to count up my ski days at the end of the season, like stuff like that. And for that, I really, you know, like you said, Dave, like I don't necessarily have to pay. I do pay. I do subscribe to Strava because I philosophically believe in kind of paying for things that I use that often. But you're right. They're in a very strange place.
Since this, like we had this discussion earlier in the week on our wee group there, and I've sort of been thinking to myself since that. Like, I was actually thinking a lot before that. Was just if my head units didn't automatically upload, would I take the time and the effort to keep my Strava up to date? I think it's probably one of those that I would maybe do like a bulk update once a month or once every 2 months. But for me now, like Strava is, yes, it's ticking away in the background. It's real nice to have like 10 years worth of data there now, and 10 years worth of rides more so than data, actually, because, you know, there's not that much analytics in it. But for me, the biggest thing on it now is just their maps, and they've done like such a real good job of, you know, route planning and the maps and the heat maps and all that, is especially like if you're
the most useful feature
trying to, yeah, by far and away the most useful feature now. And yes, I also have a subscription for Strava, so I don't, and I always have done, so I don't exactly know what is free and what is premium. But, you know, what initially got me into Strava in terms of the leaderboards and all that, it's maybe like once a year when I'm struggling a bit for motivation to keep my training going, and I'll go out and target a few KOMs. Just, you know, that's the one time per year that I actually think about that again.
I thought you were about to say, when I'm struggling for motivation, I look at my Strava, I'm like, oh, that's right, I'm a legend. And then you just...
And then only you just a local legend, Dave. Only a local legend.
I honestly think part of Strava's problem at this point, like part of the reason they did stuff like local legends, is you have to be a like near world class cyclist to get on any sort of leaderboard in large parts of the world, right? Anywhere in the world where there are a lot of cyclists at this point, or where pros ever show up, you have to, right? Like, I'm down here in Durango. It's all Sepp Kuss, Quinn Simmons, Payson McIlveen. Like, it's people that I'm never, ever, ever going to go faster than in a million years. Same thing in a place like Boulder, even 10 times more so. I think that's they kind of have to contend with that, because it's made what was their original, the thing that originally got them where they are, which is those leaderboards, it's made them like almost irrelevant, right? Because if Ronan is the only one in this trio who has a chance in heck of ever getting on getting a KOM on anything anymore, then we kind of got a problem, right?
Yeah, well, you know, you can filter it by age and that sort of thing also, which, you know, which, and by club and by group and all this sort of things.
Yeah, but you can do what my father does, which is age group, gender, club.
Weight. You can do club too, I think.
Club and then week.
And day. I think you can do day as well.
You can do day, yeah.
But what I was just going to say was that I always get, when I do go onto the app, I get this sense it's like they haven't quite figured out whether they want to be something like Training Peaks or want to be something like Instagram. And as a result, it ends up nothing like either. And, you know, I've got a timeline, but don't really feel that I've got like a great engagement with it. And even simple things like someone will, you know, mention you in a comment, but you can't actually directly reply to the comment. All you can do is either like it or ignore it. And then like the, you know, as Dave pointed out at the start, it's like the actual, in terms of training analysis and that, it just hasn't got the same tools. Like, and this is where I feel like, you know, and I don't know the size of, I'll just pick a random name, like the Today's Plan or something like that. Had Strava and Today's Plan been one thing rather than been two separate things, they might have replaced Training Peaks for me. But at the moment, I'm like diehard Training Peaks and WKO, and to move me away from either is going to take something like a combined Strava and Today's Plan sort of offering.
Yeah, it's too wide, and they haven't gone deep anywhere, right? Lots of breadth and not enough depth. And I would say that the only exception to that is in the mapping and routing capabilities, which are genuinely excellent, and are, for me, like, that's reason enough to subscribe, and you know, I use those all the time, and I use them over top of lots of other options on that front, because it just works better. It's already tapped into like the rides that I do. The heat map is so useful as a tool for like, where have I ridden before, where exactly is that corner that I'm looking for, you know, particularly off-road. It's a world-class product on that particular area, but I think everything else is it's shot for sort of the widest possible audience.
The one thing I'm really surprised I've never gotten into is, you know, and just let's remember for a second that it's not just a cycling platform. This is like multi-sport, and, you know, especially in running and other sports. And where I'm surprised they've never really tapped into is just like actually helping athletes get like training plans. And, you know, especially with AI and that coming in at the moment, if you've, you know, couched to 5K in running or couched to 50K for cycling, actually you know, providing training plans for that as well, because it's one of the actually few brands that sort of goes beyond my cycling circle. Like, other people who I know who don't cycle will also know Strava from their running or from whatever else they're doing. And while we've also got all these other, you know, 12-week training plan offerings from different online platforms, or AI training plans coming in now from the likes of Trainer Road and that, it seems like something like that to actually... Strava started out as a leaderboard basically for local segments, and they never actually got around to providing a way to try to help you move up that leaderboard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think they would argue that adding some of the training stuff that they have now was their version of that, but it... Yeah, I mean, they just raised their prices kind of across the board. There was some controversy around that, mostly around not knowing how much you were going to be paying, which they didn't do a great job communicating. Ray over at DC Rainmaker did a great piece on that in particular. If you want to go check out the details there, we don't need to go into them here. I guess, yeah, my last thought on it is, and I'm sure that they have run these numbers, there's very smart people over there, but given the fact that they have sort of shot for breadth over depth in a lot of different areas, and they have an enormous user base, I wonder if going in the opposite direction from a pricing perspective would have made more sense. Like, make it all paid, but make it like $3 or something like that, and just see how many people you convert. And you probably lose a huge, huge, huge amount of your user base, and maybe that's what they're scared of. But in the end, revenue might be higher. I don't know. I'm back in the napkin here, just spitballing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Given the way that the rest of the product is focused, it feels like a sort of low cost, high volume play versus a higher cost, lower volume play, which is kind of what they've been doing.
Yeah. It's such a hard thing because they need that mass volume for some of the features that they're selling on. Like the mapping, for example, relies on the data from having hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps millions of people, providing that data and filling out the most popular ride segments and all that, and the heat maps and everything. So, yeah, I mean, it's just such a tough place for them to be in.
Well, that's enough Strava. We've talked about Strava long enough. But it is, like I said, it's a utility. I mean, what other brand can we talk about in all of cycling where probably the majority of our listeners have used it?
It's a lightweight wheels.
Besides lightweight wheels in this particular podcast.
We can't move on yet. I just remembered my biggest problem with Strava.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You do an Everest thing, like 76 times with more gap, and within 90 days, you've lost your local legend status.
You got to space it out.
It should be some kind of like slowly decomposing thing, you know, where like if you get that high, it takes longer to go away. Something like that. I'm sure you could code that. Anyway, it's time for everyone's favorite one-week-old segment, On Your Mind and Over the Head of Your Family. What is on your mind and over the head of your family, Dave Rome?
More tools, of course. Could it be anything other? This week, on my mind is removing hub bearings with a press. So traditionally, when you think of removing bearings, or if you're a mechanic, hammer. But yeah, it's... Or a puller tool if you're fancy, but a press. So Ceramic Speed's hub tool set has done this for a little while when they first introduced it. It came with like a cup that sits around the hub shell that you then push the bearing into. So it gives you something to kind of pull against, and then you put a press from the opposite side and you could push the axle of the hub to push the bearing out. And this only works on hubs that have like the axle sort of sandwiched by the bearings, where you'd need to hammer on the axle or push on the axle, and then that takes out one of the bearing, and then you put the axle back in and you push it or hammer it again, and then that takes out the other bearing. So like DT Swiss, for example, uses a hub setup like this. But yeah, lately I've really taken to using a press for this. So yeah, Ceramic Speed were first to do it, but more recently out of the UK, there's a Noble, N-O-B-L-E, not N-O-B-L, I think is the similar brand. Also out of the UK, also does wheels, but is different spelling. Yeah, so Noble, they I guess make tools. They make like wheel building jigs and a few other really neat tools, but they came up with cool idea where you take a pre-existing tool, which is a hub a Hope Hub support tool, which typically just sits on top of the bench and you rest your hub on top of it and then you use a hammer to knock things out. You grab that and then you buy their little kit, which just has like a little plate and a little bushing that goes on the axle. And then you can use any press you want or any threaded rod you want to pull out bearings. And I'm all for smoother ways, hammer-free ways of working on bikes. So there you go. That's what's on my mind.
Boo. But what's the benefit?
You don't use a hammer.
Yeah, but a hammer works fine. Sometimes a hammer is the proper tool, Dave.
You get to buy a new tool.
You get to buy a new tool. It's the issue with the hammer is that there's actually quite a bit of risk because the axles themselves are typically quite a lightweight aluminium. So the risk with the hammer is not so much causing damage to the bearing, but causing damage to the axle itself. So like DT Swiss, for example, their hub toolkits used to come with and still do come with little adapters that would sit into the axle that would give you a nice face to hammer against. The reality is most people would just hit the axle. It's a press is just a much cleaner, much more controlled, much more gentle way of doing hub maintenance. I think being gentle to your high-end wheels is not a bad thing.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ronan, what is on your mind and over the head of your family?
Flipping heart rate straps. When did they get so terrible? Hey, I started cycling 20 years ago, and heart rate was like one of the things that was easily measured. And I literally have a wardrobe half full of broken heart rate straps.
You have a point.
And the wrist ones are completely useless.
Like, if I wanted to guess, I would just guess.
I can't say I've put a heart rate strap on in about 5 years, so I'm having trouble feeling you on this one. But how do they break? They just stop working?
I've gone through about five in the past 3-4 months, probably. Like, I've had a couple from Wahoo, a Hammerhead. I then went and bought the recommended Polar one because Polar have been doing it forever. And when I last had a Polar 20 years ago, I think it still works. It just doesn't have Bluetooth on it.
Yeah.
But the new one is just, I think it's, as they've sort of built in more tech into them, they've just, for some reason, become more fragile or whatever. Mm. So basically, the battery will go, or salt from your sweat will corrode and cause issues that way. But the only one I haven't tried, actually, is the newest of the Garmin ones. I'm just at... I've bought more coin cell batteries in the past 2 months. And it's a common problem, searching it online there's quite a few people experiencing the same issue.
Yeah, most people tend to get 1 or 2 years out of the latest straps. And so you're doing 1 or 2 years worth of riding in a few months. So it makes sense that you're cooking them. But my point is, I also remember that far back where they used to just last and last and last, and you could pick up a 10-year-old Polar strap and it would still give you a heart rate. What has changed here? What would you like to see them go back to?
It's the toaster effect, isn't it? If you have a toaster from the 60s, it probably still works, but if you have a toaster from 2 years ago, it almost certainly doesn't.
The toaster, our latest toaster purchase almost cost a divorce in this house, so let's not go into that. if you're going to buy one, let's buy one that's well-designed, but anyway, that's another rabbit hole.
But I guess my point, my thing with the toaster, and perhaps I'm on your wife's side, Ronan, am I on your side? I don't know.
Let's hear what your take is.
My take is that all toasters are terrible these days. It doesn't matter how much you spend on a toaster, it is a terrible toaster, and it's worse than a toaster that my grandmother had. They just don't make them very well. They just die. And so you might as well just go buy the $14 toaster. That's my take on it, because you're going to have to buy one every 3 years anyway, and I'd rather spend $14 every 3 years than $150 every 3 years.
I'm a little more of an optimist, to be honest, Kelly, and I believe we probably could get a toaster that will at least fit the types of bread that we toast.
That's a baseline. For,
at least for the time that it's working, we would be able to toast all of our slices rather than three quarters.
I'm with you, Ryan.
But you can buy a toaster with This is a good, this is a quality bike tangent. You can buy a toaster with the right size holes that still isn't like, I mean, this comes from personal experience. Like we at one point bought a nice toaster and then it just died in the same amount of time as all the rest of the toasters. And I was like, well, all right, we're going back to $14 toasters because the modern world, planned obsolescence of the toaster means that we just have to buy new toasters every 3 years and we just get over it. Buy a cheap one. So anyway, my point with the heart rate strap thing is that they're probably just not built as robustly as they once were. They're also a heck of a lot more complicated. And you just have this sort of toaster effect where, like, at some point you might as well just go find the cheapest one you can because they're all going to die in 6 months.
Is anyone
which is depressing, I should say. Like, that's not an ideal.
Is anyone doing a rechargeable heart rate strap with, like, induction charging?
Not that I know of, or not that springs
that
to
would,
mind. But
that would be good.
That'd be super cool.
They should.
Like, the battery thing isn't really an issue for me because, you know, with the old Polars, the batteries would last longer than... Well, I was going to say the head unit, but I found a Polar head unit about a year ago that was at least 15 years old, and it turned on and worked the day I found it. But like, I think a basics is, you know, it should be not sweat resistant, but sweat proof. You know, we're in 2023 here. If heart rate monitors are breaking down within a couple of months because they're getting corroded by sweat, that's a design flaw. It's just unforgivable, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a toaster with bread slots that are too small.
exactly like that.
We do toast pancakes sometimes and they work okay, so.
All right, I have an on my mind and over the head of my family. So there's an event here in Durango every year called the Iron Horse Bicycle Classic. The name Iron Horse comes from the fact that you race the train from here in Durango. It's a little narrow gauge train up over the mountains to Silverton. So I live at about 2,000 meters, 6,100 feet, something like that. Silverton's at, I want to say, like 2,800 or so. I'm just pulling that out, but it's higher than here. So this road event, fully closed roads, super, super fun. And you go through this big, long valley to start for like the first 45 minutes, and then you climb, and the finish is in Silverton. So you finish a couple thousand feet higher than you started, but there are two relatively fast descents in there, so it's not just like a climbing time trial, and you've got this 45 minutes through the valley at the beginning in kind of a big group that goes really fast, because like there's a lot of hitters here in Durango. So I'm trying to figure out what bike I should ride for this year, and specifically like what wheels. So last year I rode, I wasn't trying to optimize here. I rode an Athos with some kind of shallow carbon wheels. Obviously beautiful riding bike, super fun on the climbs, feels great day out. But if I wanted to optimize a bit more, knowing what you know about the route ahead of me, what, like, how deep do I go on the wheels? Do I go aero bike? This thing takes like 2.5 hours for me, and two of those hours, or an hour 45 maybe, are mostly uphill.
What sort of gradients?
Mostly in the kind of like 6-ish percent range, but keep in mind that we're at 3,000 meters. So you're not pushing anywhere near the watts that you would be. You know, I think I averaged something like 250 last year. Yeah, I can't remember what the average speed was, but actually, let me pull that up for you guys. I'll tell you.
Is it on your Strava?
It's on my Strava. So, 46.92 miles. I forget what that is in Ks. 80K? 75K? Something like that?
Just under 80K.
You climb 5,700 feet, which is 1,800 meters. Mm-hmm. Total time for this ride was 2:40, but I think my race time was something like 2:20. Average speed, 17.7 miles per hour, which is 30K an hour, right?
I think the first thing you need is definitely internal cable routing. I guess, joking aside, actually, the best question is, what are the options? You know, because if the Athos is still the only bike you have, then it's about optimizing that. Whereas if you've got other options,
I mean, well, the question is, do I go out and seek something else? I mean, you know, we work in the bike industry. I could probably pull a couple favors here and there, get a bike to borrow for the weekend. I could do that. Or I could put some deeper wheels on the Athos, which is kind of what I'm leaning toward at the moment because it rides so nice. It descends really well. You know, I'm not going to win this, right? Like Quinn Simmons won it last year. He's probably going to beat me again, I would say.
Mm. Well, but that's because he has internal cabling.
It's true. It's that Madone, right? I guess to sort of simplify it, this is my gut says this is an aero course, despite the fact that I climbed close to 2,000 meters and like it feels like the entire day is uphill because it kind of is. Despite that fact, it still feels like an aero course. What do you think, Ronan?
My gut, given that it's at this altitude and your speeds are probably, considering the amount of climbing in such a short distance and the speeds are also lower, if this was the same course but starting at sea level, I would be with you on the aero, but I think it's more to do with, I would be leaning towards aero optimizing a lightweight setup rather than making an aero optimized setup lighter.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So I would say, like, you know, 45, 50 mil rims, the right tire width, good racing tires on there. I don't know, 32 centimeter handlebars, something like that.
Not doing
that. But that's the way I would go.
They're one piece bars in the Athos, and I have zero interest in swapping those out. I think
come
40s.
On, if you're not going to take this seriously, I'm not having this conversation.
What tire width would you run, Ren?
Well, depending on the surface, the width of the rim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Roads are pretty good, and it is closed roads, so like the descents are fast. Because you're not supposed to cross the yellow line in case somebody's coming, like an ambulance or something. But it's still you can use the full width of the lane, and it's a superb event actually. Like if anybody else is in the region or anywhere nearby and wants to come do like a real road race on closed roads in the high mountains, which doesn't exist in America, like literally doesn't exist in America other than this one. You should come do it. It's awesome. All right. Well, I'll put deep wheels in the Athos.
Deeper.
That's what my gut said. But I wanted to gut check with you, Ronan.
There. Well, I mean, like, yeah. If it was me, I might be leaning. And you know, you're sort of catching me on the hop here. But off the top of my head, something like the new Ultimate or something like that. Is still going to, maybe not every bit as light as the Athos, but is going to be lighter than if we take Canyon's other offering, the Air Road. But, and all joking aside, but it does have things like internal cable routing, and it does have, you can narrow the handlebars on it, and, you know, obviously you can put whatever wheels on it, but it's still a lightweight platform that you're building from. That's maybe the direction I would be looking.
One further question. Is it windy on the climb? The final climb?
Can be.
Pretty exposed?
You're in the Rocky Mountains, so it could snow.
Yeah, yeah.
Not quite middle of summer, but it's the end of May, early June, usually Memorial Day. And, yeah, it snowed before. Weather can roll in really fast. You're higher than the highest point in Europe for most of it.
Yeah.
So... Yeah,
you're up in our sky from an Australian point of view. Yeah.
Yeah, so stuff can happen really fast, and it can get really busy, really windy. The average wind direction, the normal wind direction, is up the valley at your back. So you tailwind on the flats, and then mostly tailwind up the climbs.
Okay, all right. So you might get relevant. A bit of a sailing effect from a slightly different deeper wheel. Yeah, my question was just if it's gusty, then I'd be personally going slightly shallower for that reason. But I'm a wimp as well, so.
Yeah, maybe shallow front if it's really gnarly.
No, never. Never give in to the wind. Harness the wind.
All right. Well, that's what's been on my mind, because I'm sitting here, the bike's sitting over here next to me, and and you know, I'm thinking about the Iron Horse because, well, it snowed 2 feet here this week, but at some point here, I'll be getting back on a bicycle, and we'll need to get fit and ride over the mountain passes to Silverton. So, last on today's list, we got a PSA, a public service announcement. Dave yep. Rome, what does the public need to know?
A reminder that now that so many road bikes have gone to disc brakes, we've got a lot of new people taking up the world of disc brakes. And I'd just like to remind everyone that the fluid inside of those brakes, if you've got hydraulic brakes, the hydraulic means there's fluid in them, needs to be replaced. It's not a forever fluid. It's a consumable. And regardless of the brand of brakes you have, you should be considering having that fluid replaced at least annually. And that is much more frequent than I think most people assume when they buy into these bikes. And the reason why I say this is that you think that your brakes will tell you. Yes, Kaylee, you can say it because you've said this to me already.
Well, when we were talking about this prior to recording, I said your brakes will tell you when they need new fluid by not working particularly well. And that's generally what I either use that as an indicator, or you know, you'll be doing like a quick like lever bleed or something like that on Shimano's, right, where you just stick the cup in and stick some new fluid in, and if the stuff that comes out is black, it's probably time. That's the other good indicator.
It was time. Now it's way beyond
time.
So, and that's my point, is a lot of people will replace the fluid when they see that, and I'm basically saying that's too late. So what's possible with Shimano brakes is that mineral oil, when it goes black, you basically have like a lot of sediment and seal breakdown in that fluid, and that can actually cause like blockages inside the ports and master cylinder of the brake. So you can actually potentially damage the brake because you can't necessarily get into those ports ever again. So you can effectively cause some clogging and irreversible damage to the brake system by leaving it too long. So by continuously keeping the fluid fresh, which for a Shimano brake like annually should be enough for casual users, but people living in high mountains should really do it more frequently because the brakes experience heat cycles. But yeah, keeping that fluid fresh will actually ensure that you don't run into any unexpected issues of causing unwanted wear and tear inside that brake. Ronan?
Dave, what if a bike hasn't been used in the previous year? And I'm presuming it goes for beyond that, but let's say, for example, someone was previously a tech rider and was riding bikes that were not his, and now has a bike that hasn't had the brakes used in a couple of years and now he needs to get back on that bike. Does it need a full bleed, or is it good to go?
I'd say it depends. So officially, Shimano mineral oil should actually be okay just sitting around and not being used. It's not going to be drawing in any contaminants or really wearing down the seals by just sitting unused. Brakes using DOT fluid, like an automotive brake fluid, specifically I'm talking SRAM if you're looking on road bikes, they, regardless of whether they get used or not, that fluid is hygroscopic, so it draws water in and contains that water. So yeah, regardless of use for SRAM brakes, you should replace that fluid annually. For Shimano, it's more a usage case. Shimano and Campagnolo. So yeah, so there you go. So SRAM, their fluid, I would say there's benefits to that DOT fluid, but yeah, you probably do need to replace it more frequently, just purely out of the fact that it does absorb that water, and it creates more fluid in the system when it does that. So it also lowers the boiling point of that fluid. So they're very different reasons for why you should be replacing the fluids, but it's regardless, your fluid needs to be replaced, and you should factor that in. If you're buying a new bike or you've bought a disc brake bike, you should really be factoring that into your annual service costs, because it's something that shouldn't be ignored.
My own fluids get replaced daily.
Thank you for that.
All right, that seems like a good place to cut it off. I want to say a quick thank you to Matt Deneef, who created our theme tune for this podcast. He also created the theme tune for the Placeholders podcast. He had the unenviable job of me saying, can you make me something with xylophones? which, if you don't understand, go back and listen to the very first episode of the Placeholders, and mm-hmm. then you will understand. Anyway, thanks to Matt for this particular banger. It's fantastic. A quick reminder to review us. You can either review us in the Placeholders channel, or, like I said last episode, this podcast has its own Geek Warning channel. We'd actually love reviews on the latter if you want to do that. That would be awesome. Because that's one that doesn't have very many reviews, whereas the Placeholders has like 500 or something like that. So yeah, please do that. Please give us a review and a rating wherever you listen. iTunes is good. Spotify, whatever else. And share this. We wanted to remind you to share this episode. We all put that it on our social media. It goes a really long way. It's exponential, right? We share it on our social media. And the easiest way to do it is just to like reshare that, right? If we've got it on our Instagram, just click the little paper airplane button, put it in your story, call it good. It's hugely appreciated. And we genuinely do, when we see a bunch of those shares, we see a bump in listenership, which is a huge deal for us, particularly right now. So thank you. I think that's it for us this week. Dave, Ronan, do you guys have anything else you want to chat about?
Probably worth saying that it's not going to be this group show all the time. Just, I know we said it last week, but we've had another episode being this one, and it's another group show, but there are deep dives coming also.
Yeah, so yeah, just to reiterate, the plan is to have the group show every week, but we will be adding additional episodes on top of that, deep dives and exciting new product releases and that type of thing. So yeah, that is coming. So
lots
expect
of
more.
Yeah. Many things are coming.
Yes.
Very soon. Terrifyingly soon. Keep an eye out. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Ciao.